21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Look up your chimney, the sky ain't blue. It's kind of yellow, you know it's true.
Oh, there's nothing like the traveling Wilburys. Yeah, they really do it to me all the time. Yeah. You hear Bob Dylan in there and George Harrison? Did you know they used to sing together and hang out together? Well, they did. It's about time you knew it. So sit up straight out there, eyes straight ahead, no talking, and you can chew gum during the breaks. We are liberal, but to a degree. But we want everyone to be free. However, this is 21st Century Radio. We're moving towards our 30th year. We don't know if we'll retire after our 30th year, because we sure would like to have some Sunday nights by ourselves these days. But anyway, our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Courtney. Our engineer is Sean Roman, and we are doing some research here into what we call history. Stuff that you really don't know much about. And you can ignore it at your own peril, because there's a lot of things going on around the planet. Some of them are conspiracies and are hidden deliberately, and others are just right out in the open, but people don't pay much attention to them. We're talking a little bit about, well, let me introduce my guest once again. It's Cortland. Are you there, Court?
I'm right here.
Are you sitting up straight and no
yes,
talking?
Yes, sir. I was listening to you and following instructions.
You better have rules and regulations, 506 of the Penal Code.
Always try to do what I'm told, to a point.
Yeah, to a point, right. And he wrote, of course, The Secrets of Edgar Allan Poe, The Kensington Rune, and The Beale Treasure Reveal. We touched on all of those. But we are now in California, and we talked a little bit about that very strange flag that they have out there with the bear and the red star and everything. And since I love symbols and symbolism, and I love bears, my wife has taught me all about bears and the importance of bears. So I'm still in student mode. And there are some theories that the west coast of the United States was linked to a lost continent in one way or the other. And some called it Mu, and some called it Lemuria, and it was called other names, which I'm not going to tell you about. You'll have to find them out yourself. And that there is a possible link in a certain sense that these were very advanced beings. And one of the theories was that every now and then, one of these very tall beings that had peculiar shaped heads used to come down or come up from inside the mountain or down from the mountains. And when they had to buy some food, they didn't pay with it for money. They paid with it gold. And, of course, people were absolutely delighted to be paid in gold. And so where did they get this gold? What was going on there? Well, maybe it was just a mythological experience, but I think there's something else to it altogether, and I am so glad to know that Court has written the book. What is it called? Because I don't have it. I just checked my library. Did this book come out? Well, what's the name of it, number one, and has this book come out yet?
Yes, it's out now. It's called Mysteries and Legends of Northern California, Mount Shasta Revealed, and I'll make sure you get a few copies of it very soon.
All great. All great, because this is great night reading. You know, you pick up a volume like that around 1:30 in the morning, and you read on to 4 or 5 in the morning, which I have a habit of doing, and it's just another adventure altogether. For me, that's great learning. Do you like to read in bed, Court?
Oh, certainly. I'm a voracious reader and always have been since I was a little kid, and that's kind of what's led me to studying all this and writing about it.
Oh, it's thrilling, isn't it? I mean, you go on these little inner adventures And then sometimes these things come out in your dreams. That they ever poke to your dreams?
Oh, certainly. Sometimes I'll make a new discovery and it'll make it so I can't go to sleep for a while. So I'll read some more or whatever and just move on. You try to, if you can. It's really exciting when you actually gain enough knowledge to look at things and see what was really going on. And I think everybody's capable of doing this if you just look at things. I happen to come through it through looking at architecture and artwork, which I've always been fascinated with as well. And you just start to see inferences and suggestions of things that you can now research and associate with people who built the buildings or funded the buildings that they actually believed.
Mm-hmm.
So the people are telling you things, and they want you to kind of figure it out yourself as opposed to being told straight out. Even I'm not telling you everything.
Oh,
I would just encourage people, you know, to a point. I guess I'm exposing more than many, but to look into things yourself, because your own experiences may lead you to a really valuable insight that other people will appreciate as well, and you'll get a lot of satisfaction yourself out of knowing what that odd statue in your town really means.
That's especially because when I used to go to Drudel Park 4 or 5 times a week, I'd visit all the statues, Christopher Columbus, Wallace, the Wallace statue, and all the little gardens and all of the, I mean, there are so many. It was another world altogether.
Right, about, George Washington statue there too, I believe.
Yes, Uncle George is there. And the things that I like, of course, it's all somehow now linked, of course, to the zoo. And so I would never go to a Drudel Park without stopping by the zoo and visiting my two friends, who are two eagles. One was a golden eagle and one was a bald eagle. And I had a little communication going with these two eagles. As a matter of fact, once upon a time, I was sitting there looking at the golden eagle especially. And I said to him, look, I would love to have an eagle feather. I really would. So if you don't mind, would you please drop one close to the fence here? Just over here. It would be just about fine. I could pick it up. And of course, I didn't know it was illegal to have an eagle feather, but I still asked the eagles about this. And darn if I didn't came by about a couple of days later, and there was a couple of them. Now, for some strange reason, they had a lot of eagle feathers, but they were trashed. They were thrown in some filthy gully. And I couldn't understand why the zoo people would do that. I mean, if they're sacred and you don't want anyone to have them, treat them with respect. But anyway, fortunately, so I would frequently come by, and there would be some from the golden eagle and some from the bald eagle. So it was then that I learned that eagles are intelligent. I actually thought they were just birds, right? But there are more than just birds. Birds are more than birds. You ever had any experiences like that?
Not that I can think of right now. I'm sure the world is full of funny synchronicities and things that happen, and I've experienced that in my work, you know, down to having once lived in Williamsburg when I was younger and being exposed to everything there, and I think that had an impact on me later when I realized what I was seeing 20 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also fortunate enough to live in Chico, California, which I think is another Williamsburg that has been developed in California.
I see. Yeah. Well, look, let's go back to Mount Shasta, where you were beginning to talk to us before about.
Right. It's interesting you were talking about the eagle feathers, because in a lot of states, Native Americans are the only ones that are allowed to collect those.
Well, I was a Native American a long time ago.
That's true, too.
I was. You know, I don't think lots of us were. That's how come I fell in love with the League of the Iroquois and the Cherokee and all others when I found out the quality of their consciousness. and how they taught our founding fathers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which they still won't allow me to talk about on the History Channel or National Geographic or any of the other shows that I regularly did. But anyway, when we get to back to Mount Shasta.
Right. We were talking about the Native American myths of Mount Shasta and how they kind of reflect principles that secret societies and the Gnostics believed. The Native American myth of Mount Shasta suggests a lot of Enochian concepts, such as how the grizzly bear was made to walk upright by the creator, thus kind of inferring Bigfoot or some more Enochian concepts as well, of people living inside the mountain, kind of referring almost to the man in the mountain mythology. And as I really researched into this, I kind of found an example of a classic Charlemagne-style man in the mountain myth that had been developed at Mount Shasta long before any of the, quote, New Age theories or the theories about Lemuria or the city of Telos existing inside Mount Shasta had even come to light. And this was all part of this imperial or royal interest in California for obvious reasons of the mineral wealth and new land that could be developed. I found that even originally Sir Francis Drake had claimed California and named it New Albion. A lot of different royal interests may have thought they had a claim to California or that it was included in their domain. And this is also interesting that you, as you spoke of the flag of California, and I told you about the Russian colony, that the bear and the star are also symbols of Russia.
Yeah, that red star.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I believe in this case that the bear is referring to Arcadia or Arcus, who is Ursa Minor, the constellation in the sky that includes the pole star.
Well, you have just won a trip to Bermuda and $30,000. I think that you hit it right on the head, sir.
Well, I hope I'm right about that, and it really does seem that way, because what I found was even that a kind of little-known-of structure in Palo Alto, California, known as the Frenchman's Tower, may clue us all into what was actually going on and how the exiled King of France may have even constructed a landscape mystery in California that suggested a man in the mountain long before the more modern myths of the Lemurians and things like that being located there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this tower is really interesting because it's always been a local mystery in Palo Alto. Back in the early 2000s, I actually worked in Palo Alto and read an article in the paper, "What is the Frenchman's Tower?" when I worked there. And this is, of course, where Stanford University is located. And the Frenchman's Tower is located on the property of Stanford University that used to be the Ayrshire Farm. And as I examined this, I developed a theory that the exiled King of France, Henry V, Duc de Chambord, had built the Frenchman's Tower and developed the Ayrshire Farm as a premier stock farm there. And the more I looked into it, this is similar to Rennes-le-Château, another mystery in France that involves a strange tower in the town that had similar overtones. And as I looked into that, I found there were people that theorized that Henry V had actually financed the building of the Tour Magdala at Rennes-le-Château, another strange tower that's part of that mystery there. So I was really surprised to find that, because I had already speculated he was responsible for the one in California. As I looked into it more, I found that this strange tower in California was due south of the peak of Mount Shasta, and that interest had been shown, and that would indicate that he was making a man in the mountain mystery due to the tradition of these alchemical towers. Even the man that was known to have built the tower in Palo Alto used the name Peter Coutts, but it later became known that his name was Paulin Caperon, a French name that was also supposed to be Swiss nobility. So a lot of things about the life of this man. His dates of birth and death closely match those of Henri V, the exiled king of France. So as I began to look at this, I also found that elements of the Society of the Cincinnati at this time may have been aware of what was going on in California with these other interests being there. And that one of their, again, another author and poet named Joaquin Miller seemed to be aware of this as well. And it's interesting because Joaquin's original name is Cincinnatus.
Oh, I'll be.
So to me, that was a tip-off. Maybe there's a connection to the Society of the Cincinnati. And I did find a member, an original member named Miller, though I wasn't able to solidly link him up later. He does have relations in Indiana where Joaquin Miller was from, though I couldn't find direct evidence. It seems that he was acting in this tradition that we saw Edgar Allan Poe acting under earlier, and people like Longfellow, James Fenimore Cooper, and Samuel Morse also seemingly trying to present these ideas while still kind of in a more mystical or Rosicrucian manner, kind of carry out a silent war between divisions of imperial people trying to impact North America and California, especially at a time before it was part of the United States, and then American interest also expressing themselves and making sure that it became part of the United States as well. So I think Joaquin Miller recognized that a man in the mountain had been set up at Mount Shasta, which is a place he extensively wrote about. And in the end, he spent time in Europe with the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, which was kind of a cult-oriented artist guild that believed earlier forms of art held more legitimacy than the modern forms. And they practiced these kind of Renaissance painting techniques and things like that. But it's obvious they influenced Joaquin. And when he returned to the United States, he had political ambitions. So he moved to Washington, D.C. and lived in a log cabin on the White House Meridian for 2 years. And you can still see Joaquin Miller Park or Joaquin Miller Cabin in Rock Creek Park. They moved it from its original location very close to Meridian Hill Park, which is kind of marks the White House Meridian in Washington, D.C. And he then returned to Oakland after his stint in Washington and bought his Heights estate due south of the peak of Mount Shasta, just as Henri V, the Duc de Chambord, had possibly had the Frenchman's Tower built. Now, really, what is interesting about the Frenchman's Tower is I looked into the property of the Duc de Chambord, or Henri V owned Chateau Chambord in France. And this is a nice large chateau with a linear aspect to it. And I plotted that azimuth on the globe. And it turned out that the Chateau Chambord points directly to the Frenchman's Tower in Palo Alto, which in turn is due south of the peak of Mount Shasta. So this association, along with a lot of the research I did, led me to believe that a man in the mountain was being myth, or reality, possibly, was being created at Mount Shasta.
Well, we're going to need to take our first break of this hour. When we do return, we may be moving to the continent of Europe. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about Ravenna.
Certainly.
And because it's fascinating, I just was starting to read some of your work on that, New Jerusalem of Ravenna, and Lord Byron and Dante, et cetera, et cetera. Very interesting stuff indeed. Okay, it's time out on the playing field here. The Baltimore Colts are winning 22-0, and Court Lindahl is doing a great job quarterbacking here. I'm just assisting on the sideline here. And we've talked about the secrets of Edgar Allan Poe, and I still think there are many other secrets of Edgar Allan Poe we have not been able to bring to the surface. And we should, because this is Balmer, and being Balmer, I wager that most people who studied Edgar Allan Poe never thought of these theories here concerning Baltimore. It's one of the reasons why we do a program like this. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
21st Century Radio's Hieronymus and Company, where knowledge comes first. And now, here's something I hope you really like.
Oh, goodness. They were doing the twist, kind of. Twist by trumpet or something along those lines. And what, there's Rocky. Rocky stopped in there for a little while. We were the close friends with the voice of Rocky. You know who that was? That's right, June Foray. June Foray joined us a number of times on 21st Century Radio. We really enjoyed her. Now, we're really enjoying Cort Lindahl because he's exposing a lot of secrets here that you may or may not be interested in, but I think in another lifetime you will be. No two ways about it. We live more than once or twice. And one of the books that I've been looking at is called The Prophecy of Dante and the New Jerusalem of Ravenna. Now, is that how you pronounce that, Ravenna, or is it Ravenna?
It's Ravenna.
Oh, oops. Okay.
And but as I rudely interrupted you on the outro there, I was going to say that we're going to see how Ravenna is tapping at our window.
Just like the Beatles?
Just like The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, that, I thought you were talking about Carl Jung and his golden beetle that tapped on the window when he was synchronistically. The Raven, well, the Raven, you know, hey, by the way, our Ravens are in first place right now here. The Baltimore, are you aware of that?
No, I'm not.
Oh, you got to do research into that.
I used to be a Skins fan, but I kind of don't watch football that much anymore.
Well, I don't watch it at all, but I care about our team anyway. And we are in first place, and I don't know how we can do that when we're only, well, I think we only have 5 wins and 4 losses, and that doesn't sound like any great year. But for some reason, the division that we're in is falling apart or something like that. Now, we spent a lot of time earlier in Baltimore, and then we moved a little bit down there into Virginia. Then we went to the West Coast a little bit. What I'm saying here is that there are mysteries all over the planet. If you really think we know history from the history books, I think they've got a long way to go to really get to something that I've always been interested in certain areas of Italy because of the shape. That's right. The shape of it is this boot, right?
Yes.
And I thought to myself, you know, what is it really booting around here? You know, is it a field goaler or something like that? You know, I wanted to know, because I am an artist, I know that artists deliberately hide things in their work. They do. I do all the time. And so if I do it, I know other people do. And I've read history and know that the things are hidden all over the place. But you note that the prophecy of Dante in the New Jerusalem, Jerusalem of Ravenna, what did Lord Byron and Dante know about Ravenna and Dante?
Well, it's very complex, but I think really one of the biggest things or the largest things that is being told to us in Ravenna is that Emperor Constantine is the source of the Man in the Mountain mythology, and that he was interred in a tomb beneath the Dome of the Rock on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And the scheme of architecture and the history of Ravenna is telling us a lot of things about Gnostic Christianity and the Byzantine or Eastern views of Jesus and the faith. And really, if we examine some of the architecture in Ravenna and the people involved, like Theodoric the Great and Justinian the First, that we'll see what they are telling us is that Constantine had built an octagonal structure on the Temple Mount. There are some historical sources that do speculate that this is true, and that the ruins of this structure, or possibly it is even the same structure, was rebuilt into the Dome of the Rock later. And certainly during the reign of Justinian II, later in the 8th century, that sources say that he sent artists and engineers to Jerusalem to rebuild the Dome of the Rock in its current form at that time. One of the reasons for this is it's possible that Jerusalem was an excurate or controlled by the Muslims who paid tribute to Justinian not to invade at that time. But what we see in Ravenna is really interesting because we see a, quote, New Jerusalem built in Ravenna comprised of an alignment of church and an octagonal baptistry that predates the archetype of the New Jerusalem that most people point to as either being the Holy Sepulchre or the Dome of the Rock, which aligns with the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Temple Mount. As I looked into that, I also found that the Al-Aqsa Mosque was originally built by Justinian I as the Church of St. Mary of Justinian. So this church may have been actually built to align with the Dome of the Rock that was built a lot later to mimic an array of architecture that had already been built in Ravenna, Italy, during the early 6th century or the early 500s under the auspices of Theodoric the Great, the Ostrogothic ruler, and Justinian I. So this is telling me, this and other historical facts, that they knew that Constantine had been buried or interred or entombed beneath the Temple Mount, beneath the Dome of the Rock, thus really giving us the root of the Man in the Mountain mythology and later Rosicrucian kind of doctrine that states Christian Rosenkreutz was in, entombed somewhere in the world in a seven-sided chamber in an unknown mountain along with a library of information. I suspect that this legend or myth or concept came from Constantine being entombed beneath the Temple Mount with information such as Gnostic Gospels or other views of Christianity that were kind of made not part of the church during the canon of Nicaea. So we have the Gospel of St. Andrew, the Book of Enoch, and other Gospels, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, for instance, not being included in what is believed in, quote, the Latin church today. And Ravenna is interesting because it really reflects what was the Vatican before the Latin Church of Rome gained eminence, preeminence over the entire faith, with even the Eastern ruler of the Byzantine Empire and the Western ruler both coming from Constantinople. So what you see in Ravenna may reflect more an earlier view of Christianity just a few hundred years after Constantine, where they're showing appreciation for those kind of different views that are no longer known of or accepted today. What I found was is the Church of Saint Apollinare Nuevo, which resembles very much the Al-Aqsa Mosque interior. If you look at the architectural attributes of both buildings, they were both built during the same era, and possibly that the building we see as the Church of St. Mary Justinian or the Al-Aqsa Mosque was actually designed and built by Byzantines later. And of course, this is later where we see the Knights Templar being based on the Temple Mount later during the Crusades, and I believe they became privy to the truth of this information. So we have Santa Apollinare Nuevo aligning with the Neon Baptistry in Ravenna to create a similar array of architecture that we see on the Temple Mount today. And what is really interesting, here comes Dante. Later, many speculate that he was even a Knights Templar. And for many of the things he did and his opinions, he was exiled to Ravenna at one point during his life. And he is even entombed there. And I was amazed and astounded to find that the tomb of Dante Alighieri is situated in this New Jerusalem alignment of the Neon Baptistry and the Church of Santa Apollinare Nuevo in Ravenna. So his tomb is there right on this alignment of a New Jerusalem that actually predates the building of the archetype of what most people think is the New Jerusalem. So what they're telling you is, with all of their Greek heritage and influence in Ravenna, is that Constantine may have been interred beneath the Temple Mount with secret information or gospels that weren't included in the regular canon of the church that had been found later by the Knights Templar, and this may comprise some of the information that everyone speculates that they had, why they were allowed to gain such preeminence during that point in history in Europe to create banking systems and owning vast amounts of land and having influence in politics and many other aspects of life. So all of this relates to Ravenna. And what we see is really Dante kind of even being the archetype of what we see people attributing to Sir Francis Bacon later. Of course, I believe Poe was inspired by him in his work, including The Inferno, which he describes and talks about the King of France and the Pope, who had had the Knights Templar Grand Master burned at the stake, being in the certain levels of hell reserved for them only for their dastardly deeds, and things like this. So many people even speculate that Dante himself was a Knights Templar. So this fits the entire scheme of what I had already speculated, Constantine having been buried beneath the Temple Mount. Nobody really knows where Constantine was interred. Many people speculate it's the Church of the Holy Apostles in Constantinople, but of course his remains have never been found, and really, it's kind of odd that somebody of such note, it's not known what happened to his remains.
Well, we know what happens right about now. We need to take a break. And when we come back, Constantine and Gnosticism, this is fascinating. Because wasn't Constantine in part responsible for exiting a lot of these other Gospels? Let's talk about that when we come back, okay? Okay. All right, okay. We'll be right back with Court and Court Lindahl in just a while. By the way, on the web, survivalcell.blogspot.com, or check out his active YouTube channel.
Hi, this is Mark Carlotto, author of The Martian Enigmas, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Expand your mind.
Rudy, Mark Carlotto. Boy, you're talking about 1993. Whoa, it's been a long time since he's joined us on 21st Century Radio. Well, indeed, our guest now is Court Lindahl. And we're about ready to talk about something that is very fascinating to me, because once upon a time, I was going to be a priest. It's true. I was. And I really enjoyed serving on the altar and things of that nature. But then I bumped into the Dead Sea Scrolls. Oh, my. It caused lots of trouble in my life. Because I would go speak to other ministers, priests, etc., about the Dead Sea Scrolls, and that was a no-no. They, you know, they were not too interested in my discussing it with them. And then later on, I discovered what was discovered in 1945, Gnostic teachings. Dr. Elaine Pagels has joined us to talk about that in the past, and that really got me messed up. Because here were two different areas of sacred literature that had been destroyed and hidden, but by the church. The church literally destroyed them. And I thought to myself, how nasty of them to do so. Why did they do that? That's the reason why, one of the major reasons why I decided I could not become a minister or a priest. Because I had to deal with information which today most people still don't know much or very much about, and is still not really discussed too much amongst those that are in the traditional forms of religion. Now, Cort Lindahl, in this booklet, it's a book actually, The Prophecy of Dante and the New Jerusalem of Ravenna, is suggesting possibly that Constantine was quite aware of Gnosticism, at least carried to his, say if he carried to his grave, so to speak, buried with these teachings. Now, they must have been very important to him if that is so. Isn't that correct?
I think so. If you look at some of the things he did, if you, for instance, the Column of Constantine in Constantinople included a shrine to Mary Magdalene in which an anointing jar was part of the display.
Mm-hmm.
So that this shows you that he was aware of this and valued it. The column itself was topped with a golden Adonis-like statue of him holding a globe. And in the globe, the legend states that pieces of the Holy Rood, or the cross of Jesus, were included in the globe that he was holding. So we see in this one monument, leading us to later legends, the quest for the Holy Rood later in England, and also the anointing jar of Mary Magdalene. So you do see him expressing himself somewhat in that manner. And among Byzantine royalty, you also see a kind of predilection towards valuing symbols like the Gnostic cross, which resembles the Ankh, and things like that. So what we're kind of seeing is a Coptic overview of Christianity that developed in Ptolemaic Egypt, or Egypt when the Greeks ruled Egypt, which was, of course, for a very long time, since the time of Alexander the Great. And really, most interestingly, which will again link us to Ravenna, is the fact that Empress Theodora, the Augusta of Emperor Justinian I, his wife, was trained in Coptic Christianity in Alexandria, Egypt, long before she became the empress. And amazingly, in the mosaic of her in Basilica San Vitale in Ravenna, which is another octagonal structure that points to the Kensington runestone, in addition to the Dome of the Rock, that she is depicted with a female priesthood who are adorned with Coptic tunic patches. And in her hand, she's holding a golden jeweled chalice. So a lot of the imagery presented to you there kind of leads us to the culture of Mary Magdalene in Empress Theodora, who was also cast as a prostitute dancing girl who became empress. She created sects of nuns who were trained to weave, as she also weaved, leading us to some speculation that things were hidden in her artwork and weaving. And indeed, if we follow this concept through history, we're led to the Cathars of France, Marie of Guise and her daughter, Mary Queen of Scots, who also practiced the art of embroidery and weaving. And if you even look at some of the weaving of Mary Queen of Scots, you'll see the auspice of Maria symbol and the hooked X that are included on the Kensington runestone. And this all links in later to the same families that owned and ran the Hudson's Bay Company that I believe put the Kensington runestone there on the borders of Rupert's Land in French Louisiana. So throughout that whole story, you see the influence of the Stuarts of England possibly acting with the spirit of Mary Magdalene or some sort of value of her in addition to their Catholic faith. It's interesting is what I have found is many of the people who believe in Mary Magdalene during these periods of history seem to be devout Catholics that just also happen to have a value of her as well and the feminine aspects. In addition to Theodora, you see several other very powerful Eastern Byzantine women, Pulcheria, Galla Placidia, who also whose mausoleum is adjacent to the Basilica San Vitale in Ravenna, having a huge social and religious impact on those times and those eras. So there were some very powerful women that were part of the Eastern Church that we see being kind of shunned and cut out as the Latin Church gained eminence in their values of male, the male and female roles in religion.
Now, they so wasn't Constantine in, didn't he put down the rules as to what would happen to people that didn't observe and live by the rules and regulations, that they may end their life?
He did, but I also think that among the royal class or noble class, that there's always been this urge to practice whatever we want. And these factors we see coming from Theodora, for instance, who was trained in this kind of sect of Christianity that the Latin Church had tried to destroy, kind of kept these ideas alive. So she kind of developed her religious mores totally outside of the sphere of what was being accepted or approved by the Council of Nicaea. And part of that has to do with women, with the sacred feminine and these kind of concepts that we see being expressed through the culture of Mary Magdalene, which I think she promoted and kind of even put a safety measure there in the form of a mystery school with these sects of weaving nuns that preserved this information that later people did decipher and came to appreciate. And this includes people like Marie of Guise, the St. Clair Monastery of nuns near Paris, who were also weavers, Mary, Queen of Scots. And we see even Queen Elizabeth, even though she was not Catholic, having gained many of these kind of occult and Gnostic concepts that came to be associated with strong women through history. So I really do, if you examine Empress Theodora, you will see that yes, they were drawing outside of the lines there and thinking outside of the box, but I do think Emperor Constantine, if you look at his mother, Saint Helena, another very strong-willed woman who had a lot of influence on him, also being one of the early archaeologists, if you will, you know, going to the Holy Land and recovering pieces of the true cross, designating which sites were of importance in biblical history and things like that. So there is, in Eastern Christianity, I think early on, the women were more involved and had a powerful role in shaping what went on. And I think this kind of leads us to a lot of these notions and value of Mary Magdalene later that we see in the Da Vinci Code and Holy Blood and Holy Grail and the Rennes-le-Château mystery.
So maybe I'm just speculating here now. Maybe after Constantine laid down rules and regulations, 506 of the Penal Code, which meant you better do what the rules law says, that over a period of time, he may have, because of who you just mentioned, his mother, etc., he may have seen that perhaps only certain people with elevated awareness and consciousness could be trusted with such information, and he became more lenient as time went on, so that maybe at the time of his passing, he may have decided that these really were holy works, but not necessarily for, because as you know, in secret societies, that not everyone is qualified or given the information right away.
Right.
It's usually an initiation over a period of time. What do you think about that possibility that I just mentioned?
Well, I think you're spot on, because he created this kind of man-in-the-mountain mythology that we see later going directly to Charlemagne and him propagating these myths and legends as well. And Charlemagne even built a copy of the Dome of the Rock at Aachen Cathedral. And it's a well-known historical fact that he was obsessed with Byzantine culture. And I believe he even thought that he was related to them through his Merovingian connections, because what I saw was that earlier Byzantine emperors, just after Constantine, Arcadius and Honorius, being related or marrying into the Merovingian line, or the what later people considered the blood of Christ.
Very fascinating. This has been a wonderful journey, Court. You're a good teacher. You really are. And I really do appreciate the quality of your mind and your work and your dedication to this, because I know you're making $1 million a month on all of this work, right?
I wish. No, but it's been a labor of love, and it's kept me busy at times when my health wasn't good, and given me something to concentrate on and do that I hope everybody else appreciates. And really have never done this just for money, and I really just enjoy talking about history with people like
you. Well, we will look forward to your joining us again sometime in the future. Thank you for joining us, Court. And next week on 21st Century Radio is the Queen, Dr. Queen Zahara. Well, join me. You gotta spread the
word. Tell them what you heard. Stay connected with stimulating talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio. I'm Jack Callahan.